dignity,
security,
freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
Equality.
Equality.
Remedy. And protection.
Fairness.
Fair trial.
Citizens.
Right.
Well.
Peace.
Losers.
Men.
It's my mistake, and let me make it good. I raise the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum,
identity,
family,
home,
conscience,
expression.
Expression.
Participation.
Democracy.
Welfare.
Work.
Work.
Leisure.
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 Health.
Education.
Progress.
Culture.
Human rights.
Charter Dana.
Solidarity.
Responsibility.
Fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM. And over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on SaskTel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings, and I'm here today with my special guest, Peter Gilmer, who is an anti-poverty advocate with the Regina Anti-Poverty Ministry. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's wonderful. It's great to have you here. And the first thing, I guess, well, there's all kinds of issues that I'm sure we're going to be able to touch on. But I guess I'd like to start at the very beginning and just do a simple kind of discussion of the meaning of poverty. What is poverty?
Well, as you were mentioning the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, one of the things that struck me is that one of our definitions, we have a few, but one of the definitions that we have of human rights is that it's actually a human rights violation. That Canada, with the approval of all of the provinces in 1976, signed off on the UN International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. That UN Covenant had been in place since 1966, but because of the nature of federalism, the federal government had to have the approval of all the provinces and territories. And so in 1976, with that consensus, we committed ourselves as a nation and across the country to being signatories of that covenant. And that covenant includes things like Article 11, which talks about an adequate standard of living, meaning adequate food, shelter, clothing. It talks about a wage that allows working people to meet their basic needs or socially acceptable wage. And so, and the International Covenant on the Rights of the Child talks about things such as adequate and quality child care. And so we found that many of the issues that are identified in that covenant are issues that are of prime importance importance to us in our day-to-day work. So, for instance, things such as adequate income security benefits, a socially adequate and ultimately a living wage, quality and affordable housing and child care, and also pay equity for women and a just revenue sharing with First Nations. These are all things that we have committed ourselves to internationally. So that's one of the frameworks that we operate out of, is that poverty is a human rights violation and that we need to entrench those rights in domestic and provincial legislation and not just view these issues as public policy or social policy issues, but basic human rights that we are obligated as a society and through our governments to uphold.
So that's poverty. And so Regina Anti-Poverty Ministry, what was the sort of beginning of that? How did that come to pass?
Well, we grew out of what was the Regina Downtown Chaplaincy, which was a chaplaincy that was set up in 1971, primarily by downtown churches. It was done ecumenically through a range of churches, but which has always been based out of Knox Metropolitan United in downtown Regina. And the Reverend Bob Gay was in the position of downtown chaplain for 25 years, almost 25 years, from 1971 up until mid-1995. And he provided real leadership in terms of ensuring that low-income people, particularly in downtown Regina, but also it was serving the transient population that was going through Regina and other people who were dealing with disadvantages. It operated partly as a charitable ministry, but also as a community development ministry, working with other groups in the community to see that people's needs were being met. It was also set up because, as downtown churches, people were finding, or congregations were finding, that personnel were spending a lot of their time working on those immediate needs, and so it was felt that there needed to be an agency in place that would work with those kind of social concerns in particular. So we were built on the proud tradition of the Regina in a downtown chaplaincy, but in 1996, which was the UN International Year for the Eradication of Poverty, we changed, and that was the year that I came on, the board changed its name and constitution to better express changes that had taken place in the ministry as it had shifted from charity and community development model of ministry to primarily a social justice advocacy and public education form of ministry. And at that time, we also set up our board structure constitutionally so that we would have a mix of representation on our board. We are a social justice ministry of Wascana Presbytery of the United Church of Canada. Mm-hmm. That being said, our board is set up so that it is a mix of United Church people, representatives of other denominations or faith groups, but as well representatives of community groups that are working on poverty issues and low-income volunteers. In the 19 and a half years that I've been with the ministry, we've always had at least one-third of our board, which we would describe as first voice, or people who have lived present-day experience with poverty. We feel it's very important to have that voice in our decision-making process. So that's always been part of who we are. Myself and Bonnie Morton are the two staff people with mm-hmm. the ministry, and the work is roughly broke into three areas, or there's three prime areas that we're committed to working in. The first is what we describe as individual advocacy work. That work involves making sure that those low-income individuals and families that come to us are receiving those benefits that they're entitled to and are being treated fairly by the institutions that they're dealing with. Probably the vast majority of this casework is in some form related to income security, social assistance, Saskatchewan Assured Income for Disability. But in that area, there's a range of issues that we deal with. We also do refer people to other agencies to meet immediate needs. So individual advocacy in the casework side is one area. The second area is public education on poverty issues, which involves providing resources and workshops on a range of poverty issues. And the third area is our social justice area, which means pushing for developing a consensus on what the key issues are to move towards the elimination of poverty, and then to promote those and lobby for those policy changes. Now, ideally, we're set up to work about a third of our time in each of those three areas, but because our casework has grown significantly over the years, we've found that does take up a significant majority of our work time, and so we want to make sure that we don't lose the social change aspects of our ministry, because ultimately we're going to be continuing to deal with the same problems unless there's further reaching systemic change. So we think it's very important that we push governments and the broader society to move on policy change that would move us to the elimination of poverty.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a relationship with other agencies? Carmichael comes to mind.
Yeah, certainly we do this in several ways. I mean, just because we've been around as long as we have, we've developed a connection with a wide range of community agencies working on poverty issues. Structurally, a couple of the ways that we do it is at a Regina or municipal level, where we chair the Regina Anti-Poverty Network, which is a network of roughly 25 community agencies that are working on poverty issues, and we meet every 6 weeks to talk about concerns that are arising amongst groups in that network. We're also connected to Poverty Free Saskatchewan, which has been promoting the idea of an anti-poverty strategy for the province of Saskatchewan, and we have seen more recently the advisory group on poverty reduction set up in the province, and so we know that there's some movement on that front. That's something I will be talking about further. But also, we've worked at a national level. My coworker, Bonnie Morton, was the past president of the National Anti-Poverty Organization. She's with the Advocacy Committee for Canada Without Poverty, which grew out of the National Anti-Poverty Organization. And she's also with the Court Challenges Program, which in the Equality Advisory Group and the Poverty Advisory Group of the Court Challenges Program, looking to make sure that social and economic rights are entrenched at a national level.
Okay, when you mention courts, I think it's pretty well widely recognized that our court system just does not deal adequately with the problems that people come with addictions, with mental health problems, and other issues. Do you see any movement there to find alternatives?
Well, certainly, you know, we've been supportive of restorative justice measures. At the same time, we think that many of the long-term solutions to problems within the justice system relate to questions of social and economic justice, that too often when people think about justice, they think about strictly about the courts and what we might describe as retributive justice as opposed to distributive justice.
Right.
And certainly in the long term, I think what's been found is that those societies that strengthen their social fabric and who have greater equity and social justice in their societies are the societies that have less crime and less violence. At the same time, we certainly know that low-income people are also the major victims of crime, including violent crime, and so it's important that you know, we move towards long-term solutions for protection for people as well.
Yeah, I'm just thinking again of the court system, the justice system. I know that And a lot of the people we're talking about here are First Nations.
Right.
And they are vastly overrepresented in the prison population.
Right.
We have far too many of them locked up.
Yeah.
And it just seems to me to speak to a pretty important failure in social policy in terms of First Nations people.
Yeah. I mean, certainly, it raises a very big question. I mean, obviously, it's partly related to the history of racism and colonialism and residential schools that we've been hearing about in recent days. It also is certainly there with racism in the present day justice system that continues to need to be addressed. But you know, from a social and economic side, certainly we do know that if people do have if there is greater economic and social equity in the society, that rates of crime tend to fall considerably. And it's not those societies that are toughest on crime or who lock up people at the highest levels that reduce crime. It's those societies that do the most to limit poverty and economic inequality. And it's those societies that reduce their rates of crime.
And I think it's probably fair to say too that the judges that are involved and the prosecutors and the police, they can all see what's going on, but they have to work within the framework they're given, and they would like to see changes, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's always, I think, need for significant change in the justice system itself, and that's an ongoing process. I know from the anti-poverty ministry's perspective, and previously I spent 6 years with the Saskatchewan Coalition Against Racism, and both of these agencies have over the years have had a position in favor of a civilian oversight of policing or a community review agency, so that there is an independent body that not only investigates complaints against the police but provides ongoing input to ensure that policing processes are such that they meet with community acceptance, including all groups within a society. So that's something that we continue to push for. But we know that solutions in and of the justice system itself are not going to solve the problem. That ultimately we are going to have to have greater equity and social inclusion in our society if we want to deal seriously with the issue of crime and violence.
Right. When you start talking about income, there's two things that come to mind. And one is the $15 an hour minimum wage.
That right.
seems to be a trend that's coming across North America.
Right.
And do you have any knowledge of how that is sort of progressing here in, say, this part of the world, Saskatchewan, Regina?
what I can tell you is that, first of all, I'll give you the position that we've taken. And I should say that the positions that we've taken on policy issues have been based on a couple of factors. The human rights framework, which I mentioned earlier, but also we've had over the years, dating back to 1997, a number of conferences and consultations whereby we've developed positions in consultation with people living in poverty and community agencies dealing with poverty. And the position that we presently have that we've taken through the courts of the church, so it's not just our position, but the position of Saskatchewan Conference of the United Church, is the position that we should move as an incremental step towards the highest minimum wage in the country, or challenging for that position, but ultimately that we need to move our minimum wage to an actual living wage.
Mm-hmm.
And the one living wage that's been identified for Regina recently was by the Saskatchewan branch of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, which suggested that it would, or found through looking at the cost factors for a family of four, two parents, two children, that it would take a minimum wage of $16.42 an hour, $16.46 for both adults adults in order to meet their costs for housing, childcare, and the range of basic needs, and to provide a little bit left over for contingency and for longer term educational needs, etc. So that sounds like kind of the ballpark that we're in terms of a living wage, and certainly the $15 suggestion in other jurisdictions is one that would also be a significant movement in that direction. But we see all kinds of benefits to increases in the minimum wage, and we've always commended increases when they take place, because first of all, while it's not a panacea for dealing with poverty, it is an important part of the puzzle, that we need to make sure that all working people are paid a decent income for the work that they do, and that it is a socially adequate minimum wage that moves them out of poverty. But it's good for society as a whole for a number of reasons. One is that low-income people, including low-income working people, spend all of their income in the local economy. So boosting their incomes boosts consumer demand. It pumps money back into the local economy, because basically that's where all that income goes. At the same time, one of the positive things for minimum wage increases is the ripple effect, because there are a significant number of people in Saskatchewan working at the minimum wage in the range of 25,000 to 30,000, there's many more that are just within a few dollars above the minimum wage, and the one time that they see a raise is when the minimum wage goes up.
Right.
So it does have that positive ripple effect upwards for all low wage workers. And one of the things that the CPA study of Regina found was that we do have 23% of households living below that 1646 or that living wage income. So certainly we do have, it's not just people working at the minimum wage. There's many low wage workers that both deserve and need to have a higher wage to meet their needs. So certainly the minimum wage is an issue, and the ongoing push towards and ultimately towards the living wage is a part of is one of the key proposals that need to come into place as part of an overall anti-poverty strategy.
Yeah, and I guess my other sort of suggestion that you hear every once in a while, and it depends on who you talk to, how effective they think it would be a guaranteed annual income.
Right.
Which kind of does the same thing, but I think it ultimately could be simpler.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the guaranteed income concept is one that has a long history, and it's one that we've kind of struggled with, and I mean, actually, the United Church was one of the first groups that called for a guaranteed income back in the 1960s. And it is something that we have some support for. What we're concerned about in the interim period, though, is that we ensure that the income security programs that are presently in place are made to have greater adequacy and meet people's basic needs. The whole question of a basic income is good, but it's that combination of universality and adequacy. Like, adequacy has always been the key focus that the people that we work with have pushed on us to be pushing forward, that we need to have adequate income security programs. We need to have adequate minimum wages. And so we need to make sure that those programs are adequate presently. And until we have until there was a full basic income program in place that was adequate, one of the suggestions that we've thought about is a basic income supplement that would produce greater adequacy and would be universal, but rather than just dismantling everything that's in place, which I think would has the potential to create quite a bit of chaos and to be problematic, that it would indeed move people to all low-income people, both those dependent on income security programs and the working poor. It would move their incomes above the poverty line. So I think it's a combination of things that are needed. But on the income side, we don't want to lose sight of making sure that the present programs are much more adequate, because they continue to be inadequate, have been very inadequate over the years, and we continue to push to see that that those programs meet people's basic needs.
I just wondering what your experience has been with regard to senior governments. What so often happens with, I guess, governments of every size is you'll have meetings and you'll have experts and you'll have studies, and everybody will agree that this is a good idea and that this would help and this would solve the problem, and everybody goes home and nothing happens.
Right. Well, I guess that, certainly we've had a history of meeting with all levels of government through our ministry, both through the ministry, but also at a provincial level. As part of the United Church, we are part of an annual presentation to both government and opposition in terms of issues put forward through the courts of the church, which usually include poverty issues. So we've certainly got experience at that level, and we have seen some progress in some areas based on that dialogue. That being said, we know that that too often recommendations and issues that do have a community consensus just don't find their way into public policy, that there is a significant resistance. This becomes significant right now with the with a poverty reduction plan being discussed and an advisory group on poverty reduction in place. And one of the things we've said about that is that on the one hand, you absolutely have to have a plan and a strategy in order to have a roadmap for where you're going. That's an essential part of it. But there's also essential components of such a strategy. And ultimately, we'll judge the strategy and the plan by whether or not those things which have consistently been called for by low-income people, anti-poverty groups and other community agencies, whether those come into effect or not. And, you know, just in terms of it's not exclusive, but what we find is that there's certain issues that just arise over and over and over again, and which we have lobbied for consistently, and that the short list is that we need to have adequate income security benefits for all social programs, as we've talked about. We need to have a socially adequate and ultimately a living wage. We need to have quality and affordable housing and childcare, which have been the key cost indicators and issues for low-income families. We need to have greater equity initiatives, so that we have to recognize that there are those groups that have borne the brunt of poverty in our society: Indigenous people, new Canadians, women, people with disabilities. We need to ensure that we're creating greater equity in our society, and ultimately, that leads to the question as well about wealth distribution and fair taxation, that there is a growing body of public health research that shows that it's not the overall amount of wealth, at least beyond a certain level of wealth, it's not the overall amount of wealth that a society has, it's how equitably that wealth is distributed that affects a wide range of health and quality of life factors. So if you have a narrower gap between rich and poor, you have better health in your society, you have better mental health, you have fewer addictions, you have less violence, you have a higher status of women, you have greater environmental sustainability. There's just a wide range of health and quality of life factors are improved when we narrow that gap. So we have to take that issue of economic inequality seriously in this dialogue.
You're listening to Human Rights Radio. I'm Jim Hutchings. I'm speaking with Peter Gilmer, an anti-poverty advocate with the Regina Anti-Poverty Ministry. And we're going to take a break here right now. And I asked Peter if he had a favorite piece of music that we'd like to play after the break. And he wants to play some Bruce Cockburn. So we'll do the break, and then we'll hear some Bruce Cockburn, and then we'll be right back.
a fallen one. Working and waiting for the night to come, and waiting for a, and waiting for a, and waiting for a miracle. Somewhere out there is a place that's cool, where peace and balance are the rules. Working toward a future like some kind of mystic Jew, and waiting for a, and waiting for a, and waiting for a miracle. You rub your palm on the grimy pane in the hope that you can see.
And that's Bruce Coburn, Waiting for a Miracle. And I guess that's what we're kind of waiting for here sometimes, Peter.
That's right.
One thing I wanted to touch on, another concept that has sort of come to the fore here in the last few weeks, is the, well, actually it's been around for a while, is Housing First.
Right. Well, we certainly support the concept of Housing First, whereby you ensure that while people may be dealing with other issues in their lives, that we make sure that there is a stable roof over people's heads first, that that's a component that's a key starting point, that without that stability, nothing else is going to work. That being said, as with many policy issues, it of itself is not a panacea. That we know that there's certainly a number of the people that we work with that would benefit from Housing First programs, but we also have many folks who there's a lot of low-income folks who are just dealing with that issue of lack of availability, lack of affordability, lack of quality of their housing units. So there's a broad range of things that need to happen, and one of them that we think is absolutely essential is an expansion of social housing in the province. That's something that has remain stagnant during what's now going on close to a decade of a housing crisis here, has been that we haven't seen the expansion of social housing. And ultimately, you know, the federal government got out of social housing back in 1993. We need to see the federal government step up to the plate and put resources back in as well. Mm-hmm. But the province has to make this a top priority, that strictly leaving issues to the market, or even the focus on market incentives, which isn't a bad thing. I mean, we certainly think that there needs to be that expansion, and we have seen an expansion in terms of availability of housing. What we haven't seen is the corresponding affordability of housing. So, you know, keeping with the definition of affordable housing as being, as people not, households not spending more than 30% of their income on housing, that we need to make sure that stock is expanded. So I think that should be a top facilitation priority and a top funding priority for all levels of mm-hmm. government. At the same time, at a provincial level, one of the things that we have long taken a position in favor of and continue to do so, it has been rent controls, at least on low and mid-range accommodations, so that at present all we have in place is that landlords can only raise the rent. They can only give notice of raising the rent. Can only raise the rent once a year or once every 6 months if they belong to the landlords' association. We think that we have to move beyond that level of control to actually having a control on the amounts that rents can be raised in any given year. And it's our belief that a reasonable accommodation can be made between landlords, tenants, and government to come up with reasonable limits on increases that can ensure that on the one hand, you know, private landlords are able to maintain their properties and earn a decent profit, but at the same time that tenants are protected. Ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, those that do have wealth and power in our society are usually able to look out for those their own interests, but government, we believe, has an absolutely key responsibility to protect those people who are most economically vulnerable, and we believe that part of that protection is rent controls, because we just have seen so much hardship for so many people based on the fast rising rents over the course of the last 9 years.
Mm-hmm. Has it been helpful to have Sean Fraser on council, former Director Carmichael?
Yeah, certainly having, it is helpful for us whenever we have people who come from a community background move into those positions. It's certainly a connection that we appreciate, and you know, we will continue to make use of relationship that was developed previously.
And, you know, it occurs to me, too, all this stuff is interrelated. If we had a guaranteed annual income, then we wouldn't have to worry as much about affordable housing.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things that we say at the ministry is that, or we find at the ministry, is that people come to us for many different reasons, and we've been handling over 2,000 cases a year for over the last decade, with only one exception, which was just below 2,000. And so we find people will come to us for many different reasons, but the one common denominator is A, people come to us because their incomes are too low, and B, their costs for basic needs, housing being a prime one, are too high. So, you know, we do need to, it may sound simplistic, but unfortunately the obvious isn't said often enough, and that is that a big problem for low-income people is that their incomes are too low, and we need to be ensuring that that we find ways to put more money in people's pockets, and also ensure that the costs for basic needs are affordable.
Right. And of course, among the many benefits of the Housing First program, the chief ones are that the people that you manage to get into a stable housing situation, you're not going to find them as often utilizing the emergency services. They're not getting ambulance rides. They're not showing up in emergency. They're not dealing with the police. They're not in the courts as much. You know, the percentage goes down. And what administrations across the country, across the continent have discovered is they're saving money.
Yeah.
They're saving money so they can afford to do the affordable housing option, because the savings they realize in these other areas are huge.
Yeah, there are huge cost benefits to reducing poverty. Well, ultimately eliminating poverty would save us a ton of money. Like we know from the Poverty Costs campaign that poverty costs Saskatchewan $3.8 billion a year, which is far more than what we're spending to alleviate poverty. Also, the cost of homelessness is absolutely huge. The cost to house everybody would be far less expensive. And as you say, the cost to emergency services, etc., are very large. And that's one of the strengths and one of the ripple strengths of Housing First programs, is that if you do ensure that that some of the most vulnerable people are moved out of homelessness, that the cost savings on that can ultimately be redirected to more affordability of housing for other low-income folks. So certainly it is a positive ripple effect. But we do have to realize that both reducing poverty and moving to ensure affordable housing for all is actually a huge cost benefit for our society in the long run. And we can't just be looking at the kind of next budget cycle. We have to be looking at you know, what is it that's going to make our social fabric and our budget capacity in the long run better. And I think certainly moving on these items will.
And you know, Peter, these are not new ideas.
No.
They're not new ideas, and people know about them. And I think it's fair to say that people up in these senior governments know about them. What's the big holdup? Why can't they seem to do something along this line?
Well, I guess there's both a negative and a positive here. And the negative is that we haven't seen enough movement over the years. But the positive thing is that because there are solutions, and that because ultimately issues of poverty and housing relate to issues of public policy and economic inequality, we know that there are solutions out there. What is ultimately needed is the public and political will to make them happen. And we believe that, certainly there needs to be leadership at all levels, and including political leadership. But our sense is that when the people lead, the leaders follow. And so it's absolutely essential that people who are concerned and who want to promote these issues have their voices heard, because if there does become tipping points, and ultimately governments will listen when they believe that there's enough public support there. I know that my experience is that the politicians are very sensitive to polling. They're very sensitive to what they're hearing. And ultimately, if a leadership role is taken at a grassroots level and throughout the general public, that ultimately politicians will fall into line. But politicians need to be hearing it.
So the bottom line here really is, if we want to see change, then we all have to become activists.
That's right.
We have to talk to our councillors. We have to talk to our MLAs. We have to talk to our MPs, write letters, and make our opinions known. And think about this. I think there are a lot of people who they've got busy lives. You know, there's so many people out there, they've got busy lives, and they really don't spend much time thinking about any issues, really. I know people that don't watch the news. They don't want to hear the news. They don't want to be bothered by these issues that are concerning. So I guess we have to ask people to kind of shift gears here a little bit and become more aware of what's going on in their community. And when they see some solutions that make sense, and they see that our political office holders are not grabbing hold of the ball and taking the ball and running with it, we have to encourage them. We have to encourage our political leaders. We have to talk to people about this to make it happen.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the summary, because that I think that's a really good overview of many of the suggestions that we make to people when they're asked about what they can do. We know certainly in the churches and in much of the broader community that there's a lot of good charity work that's done. And what we often say is that, you know, charity is absolutely necessary, but charity can't solve the problem, and that some of the time that goes towards charity also needs to be put towards social justice. And that one analogy that I've heard is that charity can help heal the wounds, but it doesn't stop the blows that cause them. And so we need to be focused on both levels. In the interim, charity, as I said, is necessary, but we also have to be dealing with what the what's causing the problem in the first place. Mm-hmm. And when you're talking about people's busy lives, I certainly know that with our the people we're working with who are coming to us on a day-to-day basis, you know, in many cases low-income people have so much on their plate trying to meet their day-to-day needs that when we try and suggest forms of activism to them, that's kind of more than they can handle at the time. That being said, what we found is that many of those folks are now playing a leadership role, whether it's on our board or through through the networks that we're working with. And so certainly we're seeing that there is a lot of grassroots leadership that's taking place, and that's something to build on.
When you mention it, I think I've noticed the same sort of thing, where a lot of the people out there who are now leaders, or they're now at the pointy end, you know, delivering services and helping people, were once themselves in need of help, received it, and are grateful for it, and they want to help as well.
Yeah, that's certainly what we're finding in terms of many of the people who've moved into leadership roles with our organization and others.
Well, I'm just going to shift gears here for a moment, Peter, because today is the 5th of June. That makes tomorrow the 6th of June, and if you are a regular listener to CJTR, you will know that the 6th of June is our 17th annual CJTR Music Garage Sale. And that is not to be missed. If you come down here and check out what we have all kinds of LPs, we have CDs, we have audio equipment. If anybody's looking for a snake, if you've ever done anything in audio, you'll know what a snake is. That's where you combine microphone cables into one big cable, so it runs between the stage and your soundboard. maybe I'm telling you too much, but anyway, there's a couple of snakes I saw there. So if you'd like a snake, we have them. And there's speakers, there's some instruments. I saw some guitars. Yeah. So anyway, this is a fundraiser for us, and this is happening tomorrow on the main floor at 1102 8th Avenue. That's the old GMC building, and it's going to start at 9 o'clock in the morning tomorrow, and it'll run to 5 in the afternoon. All money raised from our sale supports CJTR, your nonprofit community radio station. So bring your $1 admission fee and come down to our music garage sale tomorrow, June 6th, from 9 to 5 p.m. So there's my spiel for the garage sale. And it's great. And if you want, we'll give you a tour of our station, of our facilities here, because we'll be live on the air. And sometimes if you have a piece of music you'd like to hear on the air, we can bring it up and play it on the radio, and you can talk to programmers. You might even become a programmer yourself. I've seen it happen. You could be a programmer, Peter.
Oh, I doubt it. Those who know me know my technical skills are pretty weak.
But anyway, just to recap here, and you know, in terms, I guess the program I'm most impressed with is the idea of looking after people who are in distress, you know, and not just sort of putting a Band-Aid on the problem and pushing them out the door, but looking at a comprehensive approach to putting them on the road to permanent, you know, long-term recovery. People who have health issues, whether they're mental health or whether they're addictions or whatever their problems happen to be, this housing first approach makes it possible to start addressing those problems. So you give them a permanent place to live, and then you start from there. Then you have other agencies that can access them because they know where to find them. They have a home. So they don't sort of disappear once they've been looked after by a social worker or by a health worker or something like that. They're gone. Oh, what? How are they doing? We don't know. Well, if they have a permanent residence, you can go and find them. And so these problems get addressed on a consistent basis. And we know it can be done. The community of Medicine Hat, if you've been watching the news, those of you who watch the news, and if you haven't watched the news, check on the internet. Look up Medicine Hat and homelessness, and you will find that the mayor, who considers himself pretty much a redneck kind of person in terms of social policy, he was sold on this, and he's completely sold on it. And now if a person is homeless and ends up in a shelter in Medicine Hat for, I think it's 10 days, they will put him in his own apartment, him or her. And they've got the key to the place, it's theirs. And that's where it starts. And I think just having a permanent place to live just gives people that feeling of, I don't know, it's a bit more self-dignity, self-worth, and it's just a positive starting place, and things just go on getting better from there.
Thank you, Jim.
We've still got a couple of minutes here. Are there any things upcoming in terms of anti-poverty that you'd like to mention, Peter, before we say goodbye?
Well, I guess one thing I would just mention is a few times I've talked about the advisory group on poverty reduction, and we were at the community roundtable, our provincial roundtable that was held in Saskatoon at the end of April. We know that the advisory group is going to be coming back with recommendations shortly, which we expect will be made public. So that's something that's going to, I think, give everybody a sense of what's being suggested, and we're certainly looking forward to seeing what's there, and I mean, hopefully it will be many of the things that have been suggested consistently over the years in which we've talked about this morning.
And if anybody wants to help in the work that you do, can they get in touch with you?
Yes, our office number is 352-6386, area code 306, 306-352-6386. We're always looking for people who would like to help out. Generally, when we're looking at volunteers, we look at some of the special projects that we're involved in, but we'd be happy to talk to you about some of those options. And I have to put in the pitch as well. We certainly rely, we are a charitable organization ourselves, so we do rely on financial donations. So certainly that is something that that we would much appreciate, as well as any financial support.
Peter Gilmer, thank you very much for being on Human Rights Radio, and hopefully we'll have you back again sometime.
I really appreciate it, Jim.
As we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For information on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."